This week marks 400 years since the forced arrival of the first enslaved Africans in the American colonies. Historians say August 25th, 1619 was likely the date. And so this week, we're going to be hearing stories about where it all began, Africa, by our own Roopa Shenoy. Roopa's been looking at how people today are still linked to that past. And to start, she's focusing on one person in particular.
I first met Rachel last fall when I drove out to see her in central Massachusetts.
What got you interested in her in the first place?
I saw an article she wrote about her work in Ghana. Rachel is Ghanaian and English. She grew up in Singapore, and now she's a professor at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. And she wrote about finding her own name at a slave castle where she's doing an archaeological dig.
Her own actual last name?
Yeah, her name is Rachel Engman, and she found that name, Engman, and that led her to some surprising discoveries about her own family history. So we had coffee and agreed to meet again at the dig site in Ghana's capital, Accra, and that's how I ended up going to West Africa.
And that's where this story starts?
That's where the story starts. Right in the middle of Accra's coastline, there's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. A castle with a wall around it.
Hi! Hi. Welcome to Ghana. Nice to see you.
We meet Rachel Engman just outside and walk together through a checkpoint. Inside is Christiansborg Castle, a stone building 3 stories tall with arched windows. It's painted so white it almost seems to glow in the sun. The lower levels are the dungeons where many captive Africans died in cave-like cells with low ceilings.
It feels like you're suffocating here.
The Dutch had this place built. In the 16 and 1700s, they used it to transport and sell 125,000 Africans into slavery, most in what today is the U.S. Virgin Islands.
I wouldn't stay here after nightfall, after dark. I always leave at about 5:30, 6. Even if I have to do something in the office, I never stay late.
Do you know what you're scared of?
Ghosts, yeah, ghosts. People hear sounds, people hear footsteps, people hear crying. So I won't stay here late.
Rachel was raised in Singapore and began visiting here in 2005. One of her Ghanaian aunts told her there was something at this castle she should see.
And so she said to me, oh, you know, you're interested in culture, you should go to the castle and see, she said, see your name on the wall. So, of course, my surname is her surname, but when she relayed it to me, she said my, she didn't say our surname, she said my surname.
Rachel found the name in the castle courtyard, inscribed on the side of a water cistern. It said Carl Gustav Engman, 1757. Rachel had heard of a person with that name in her family history, a Danish man who came here when the Danes occupied the area.
I'd grown up with the understanding that he was a missionary.
That was the family lore. But Rachel found Carl Gustav Engman's papers in the National Archives in Denmark.
So I discovered clearly he's not a missionary, he was a governor.
For 5 years, that Engman oversaw the sale of captive Africans. He was on the board of the Danish slave trading company, and he owned enslaved people himself. That didn't keep Engman from also marrying an African, Ashokai, the daughter of a chief of the local Ga ethnic group.
Yeah, I think about Ashokai a lot. Yeah.
But the governor, so was he the guy like actually signing off on the shipments?
Yeah. Yeah.
Engman later returned to Denmark, but not before he and Ashokai started the Engman line in Ghana. The family line that generations later produced Rachel's father and Rachel. She's still trying to understand how she feels about being the direct descendant of slavers.
This will sound like I'm avoiding it, which I'm not really, but I think I need time to process this.
But finding that name in a way tied her to this castle. Rachel wanted to know more about it, and she was looking for a subject to focus on for her graduate studies. She went to the Ghanaian president to ask for permission to do an archaeological dig. We walk through the castle gardens. I see courtyards, fountains, a peacock, and clothes drying on a line behind the president's small house. We reach a trench and find Rachel's team at work. It looks like they've uncovered the foundation of a settlement.
Here, this started off as a 1 meter by 1 meter. So this is 5 years.
You've been looking at this hole for how many years?
Next month will be the sixth season.
Are there ever any of those moments you see in the movies where, you know, someone finds something and they, like, hold it up and everyone's like, oh, wow.
Yeah. We found bottles. I'll show you them. So this complete area down to there was bottles. And so we've left some of them in there.
Yeah.
You see this sticking out on the side of this wall? But when we first found that, we thought, it's either two things, because there were a lot. It's either a ritual or it's a dumping ground. As we found more and more and more, we realized it's not a ritual because there was no other associated objects. So it was simply a dumping ground. But in terms of consumption, you know, a lot of soda water, tonic water, alcohol, spirits.
So are we looking at a building and these are internal walls or are they separate?
So we are still not sure, but we think they're rooms. At first I thought this was an external wall like this when we first started there, and then we realized it started going off into what seems to be rooms and then platforms. We haven't reached the bottom, but because I'm concerned about the wall, if you look over there,
she points to the uncovered remnants of an old limestone castle wall.
The wall has crumbled because we had the grass cutter, which is a bushmeat. It's like a giant rodent. People eat it. Yeah, so it, like, went in there and had a disco. It did that over here, too. So, you know, I had to consult. There's a kid outside who, like, catches grass cutter and sells it. So I had to ask him to come in. I had to, like, seek consultation on how to, like, stop the grass cutter and what to do. So there's, like, me here, and there's, like, this, you know, 10-year-old kid. You know, he doesn't go to school, so that's how he feeds himself. So I'm like, okay, what do I have to do?
Around us, Rachel's team is carefully scooping and sifting dirt. They're local men and one woman. Rachel's trying to recruit more. Many are direct descendants of Danish men who married women in the local Ga ethnic group. And these descendants bring their own expertise. For generations, their families have passed down oral narratives about what happened at the castle.
This gentleman here is a wolf from the wolf family, another Danish Ga family. This gentleman here is a Swanaka, so another Danish guy.
Rachel's hoping her team can use the skills they've learned here to get other jobs.
And so my hope would be that it can help create employment, because many of them have not worked since last year when we were here. Not a single day's work, because there are no jobs.
One of the team members, his name is Benjamin Odinke Annan, he lives in the neighborhood right next to the castle. We take a walk there.
We're right on the other side.
Originally a fishing village, decades later, it's now one of Accra's most impoverished neighborhoods. People who live here often don't get a formal education. Their homes don't have toilets. On the beach, there are dumpsters full of trash. The castle looms behind them. Benjamin's grandmothers had told him what happened there, but he said he understood much more by working with Rachel.
Because of archaeology, I've learned something.
Also, because of archaeology, he has more money. He's sending his three boys, Richmond, Jonathan, and Abe, to private school.
If you have something, then you have to push your children to go better school. I don't want them to suffer.
I ask Benjamin what he thinks about money being spent to unearth the past on one side of the castle wall, while on the other side, he and his community could really use the cash. He says if the castle's turned into a museum, as the government plans, it'll enrich the whole area, although Benjamin and other workers haven't gotten any guarantees. Still, he imagines his son one day seeing his name in the museum, saying he helped make it happen.
So everything is kept here because of tight security.
Rachel shows me the artifacts they've gathered so far that the government hopes to feature in the museum. They're sorted into labeled boxes in her office high in the castle.
So when they come up from down below, everything is literally a mixed bag. So you'll have all kinds of objects in here, and then we'll divide them up and categorize them. So we have local pottery there, smoking pipes there, more bottles, shells. So yeah, we have writing slate. So this is how they would have taught young children. There was a mulatto school here in the castle, so this is how they would have taught them how to write with a slate.
She's found items from Africa, Europe, and Asia. Some need to go to a lab to be dated. Others are as recent as the time period after Ghana's 1957 independence, when the castle became the seat of government for the new republic. But most of the pieces collected come from the Danish slave period. Some of these items were traded for people.
You know, everything would have come on the ships from there to here. Then humans would have been gone from here to the Caribbean or to the south. So they would come here, then they would refit the ship and then take them.
One day, these pieces might help historians understand what the value of a human life was during the transatlantic slave trade.
I can put this under the microscope, and then I can track this trademark. So which country, which city, which town, which manufacturer.
The dig's funded by grants and awards from the U.S. Rachel's learned to do things carefully in culturally appropriate ways, like regularly visiting and updating the local chiefs. Everything she does reflects on her Ghanaian family.
But it's nice in that, seeing as I find all the funding, I can run the project the way that I think it should be run. So there's also freedom in that, which I really appreciate.
As we walk back to the dig site, Rachel explains that this project could help fill in the broad gaps in established history, an African history that's largely based on European accounts.
And because, you know, these are written by Europeans from a European white male colonial perspective, and they're also written for, you know, political reasons. So, you know, they're not going to mention a lot of things, or if they do, they're often in a negative way. But, you know, clearly they were having relationships with these people, because otherwise you wouldn't have members of my team with these Danish names or myself with a Danish name. So, but, you know, they're never going to write in the correspondence going back to Copenhagen, you know, like, oh, I married someone, or I shacked up with someone, or, you know, whatever. They're never going to write that, right?
The European accounts usually don't mention the Ghanaians who lived and worked with the slavers, or the thriving local community that did business with them. But the items Rachel's collected show they existed.
And so I think this is difficult for people to accept, because whenever people want to talk about slavery or slave trade, and we want to talk about African agency, it's always about resistance. And my project is not one of resistance. It's one of collaboration.
Some Africans acted out of self-interest and sold their fellow countrymen. Some Europeans both enslaved Africans and married them. Rachel says it may be easier to think that people who participated in the slave trade were simply bad or evil. But the truth is much more complex. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Accra, Ghana.
We have photos of what Rachel Engman unearthed at Christiansborg Castle on our website. And while you're there, take time to read her first-person essay about combing through history in her archaeological digs at the castle. That's all online at theworld.org. Our series continues tomorrow when Rupa looks at the experiences of African Americans who are living in Ghana today.
We were constantly, my generation, trying to prove to white people that we were good enough, we were smart enough, that we deserved to be there. That was a huge big burden. We had to prove that to every white person we went, every job we had. But after I had gone to those castles, I didn't care what you thought. You just couldn't define me anymore.
The history had never really been taught. And what history was taught was very sanitized. It was a disaster. A lot of African Americans were very disappointed to find this kind of blasé attitude.
That's tomorrow on The World.